What?
This is Northwest Notes. 2 hours of hours of nothing but Northwest music.
And welcome to a little kind of bonus podcast content that we're putting together here with Zeres of Zeron and myself, Austin. How's it going?
Hey, Austin, we had some fun, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, so the idea behind this conversation was that while we were doing the 4-hour show, which was these kind of rare selections of tapes and records and different recordings live and whatever, right. That we wanted to fit it in as much as possible. So we weren't talking much.
Right.
And we were trying to just kind of do the quick rundown of here's what we played, here's the next batch of songs. this idea was to kind of slow down a little bit where we don't have a ticking clock and we're not trying to squeeze in as much as possible and just talk a little more casually about what we played and whatnot. Because there's quite a bit of stuff here. And
indeed.
Some of it has a little bit of meaning and whatnot. Now, we broke these into different sections.
Right.
And I think kind of talking about them by section makes the most sense.
Right.
Oh, hey, gotta love that. Little phone action on the podcast. You can tell them that they showed up on the show.
Okay.
Part one, now, so last week we did a 2-hour show. And it kind of broke into these sections where we led off with Rural Ruminations.
Yeah, that's what I called that section, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what inspired this selection of tunes, these choices?
Well, even though it's not my favorite kind of music, I thought it ought to be represented, and it might be a nice way to introduce our concept.
Mm-hmm. And the lead tune is really kind of like this one that really kicks that off in a big way, because it was actually not only a local group, but it's kind of like this country rock hit.
Yeah, kind of a folk rock little ditty. Mm-hmm. That was a hit in 1974. Mm-hmm. Oregon, I Can't Go Home.
Yeah.
Big part of my youth, and because it's from Oregon, the band is from Monmouth. Black Hawk County, they're called. And when it hit the top 40, old Casey Kasem got on the radio and announced it. And everyone in my school was real excited because here was something from Oregon.
Because they would never announce, every other song was from like L.A. or New York or right. Some big city. And then suddenly this song that was on the radio was from like, down the road.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then it's the song is about someone from Coos Bay, which was my hometown at the time.
Was that, did they know that at the time, or was that something that came out later?
Casey Kasem told the story. I don't remember if he mentioned Coos Bay, but he mentioned she was from Oregon. Of course. So she had been traveling abroad and was captured by Turkish police for sort of a misunderstanding and put in jail.
Yeah.
And this band did a sort of a tribute to her and tried to kind of put themselves in her shoes and think about what it was like to miss Oregon when you're in a jail in a foreign land.
Yeah, wow. You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about when they travel and hearing about Oregon and how pleasant that is to them when they're far away. And so
right.
I can imagine it's even amplified worse if you are imprisoned.
Indeed.
Yeah, you mentioned Coos Bay because it's not just, I mean, you have a pretty fond connection to this. You grew up there, right?
Yeah, my high school and junior high years were in the town of Coos Bay, Oregon.
Yeah, and so there's in this Rural Ruminations section, we've got a few Coos Bay and Coos Bay connected
Correct.
Tunes and whatnot.
Right.
Did you want to talk about some of these selections and what inspired these?
Well, sure. I guess the second song was Christopher Todd Davis doing his tune Old Coos Bay. That was recorded in the White Eagle in Portland, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Just a live thing I found on YouTube. But it's about Coos Bay, and so much of that tune reflects my experience. He talks about the high school looking like a prison on the hill. And, of course, we all saw that and said that back in my day, which was probably 10 years before his day.
Right.
So the experience can continue.
It really resonated in a way that felt real.
Absolutely.
Those personal connections with songs are kind of like why we love music, is that they have these lines or these moments that we really connect with.
Right. I mean, I don't listen to country music or even very much folk music, but that song,
mm-hmm.
I like it,
yeah.
Even though it fits in those categories.
Now, there's not a lot of this in the first show, but you actually appear on the next recording, the Going Hunting tune.
Correct. Griffin, Fard, and Ferd was my friend Matt Griffin and Bill Feifel and me, Zeris Ferd. And so it was mostly Matt's project.
Mm-hmm.
And
People contribute here and there.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so my contribution, as well as Bill's, was the growls and grunts in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little kazoo bit also.
That was the part I remember you pointing out, where I was like, oh, I like that. That's pretty.
Yep.
That's pretty good.
The kazoo.
Now, we got a bunch of things in this kind of rural rumination section that are not necessarily you connected, but, this was kind of a nice little block of tunes here.
Well, there's a transitional moment here. The other guy who was making the growls and grunts, Bill Feifel, is the leader of this band, Billy Duane and the Creepers.
Oh, I see.
Rockabilly band from Seattle, but he was my buddy back in Coos Bay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's Ford a lot of connections. Ford Fairlane 500.
Right. There's a lot of connections to people who start out in Coos Bay and go on to other things.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. A song that really spoke to me in a lot of ways, because I remember making many of these, Beer Run.
Yeah.
It's a cute, silly song.
Right, the Todd Snyder song. And, he fits the Northwest thing because he was born in Portland.
Sure. Ben Bochner?
Ben Bochner was a friend of mine, recently deceased.
Yeah.
And I just thought I'd throw him in. I've worked with him on some things in the past, but not this one. This is his burgeoning folk career that got cut short.
Mm, yeah. Unfortunately, that happens to far too many people who make music. Sometimes when they just getting started is unfortunately the end.
Right.
Yeah. And then we kind of switch gears tremendously after that.
Right, we move to our little New Age World Fusion section.
Yeah, so like at the end of our little country set, we do a little, a twofer, as it were.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Harrison was the piano piece, and one would often hear him improvising around the U of O campus back when I went to college, so...
Yeah, before he was the Michael Harrison that...
Of Windham Hill.
Right, people know now. which was really strange, too, because, I imagine most people never heard full performances. They just kind of walk past and hear a little snippet there.
You know, that's a good point.
Snippet there.
And... Right, I'd be riding my bike, so it would be kind of Dopplered as I went
past. So you're getting a very experimental version of his performance.
Right,
yeah. And then a little bit from Oregon.
Oregon, the band called Oregon.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a jazz band because it was on the Vanguard label. But actually, I think World Fusion is more accurate, and it inspired a lot of new age bands like the Paul Weiner consort came after.
Yeah.
And two of the alumni of that band originally met while they were in college at U of O.
Oh, that's right. That's right. In the 60s, right?
Yeah, it was pretty early on.
Yeah.
64-ish, 3-ish, something like that.
So that's kind of the first block of tunes. And then we move into this basically hour-long segment, which was the kind of larger chunk of that first show, the Panic Favorites.
That's right.
This is, you know, related to, I mean, we mentioned this on the air a little bit, but I guess we can go to a little more detail.
Sure.
I recently did an interview with Jeff Sellers, who manages the Panic on 13th blog.
Right.
Which is a really good representation of the Eugene music scene. I mean, as he kind of caps it off in, by like 1995, I think, for the most part.
Yeah, 1980s and 1995 is the era he focuses on.
Yeah, and these are like demo tapes, home released, self-released kind of things. Yeah. Things that were in circulation around town, or maybe just among friends, but like, we're never full albums, big releases, or anything like that.
Not hardly. Yeah. I mean,
so, you know, you may have heard some of these things, but there's not much. So, included in the show notes, which I recommend you check out, there'll be a link to the interview I did with Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
It gives you a little more kind of insight into these tunes. Because, I mean, as I've mentioned before, and what I think both you and I kind of pick up on and connect with, these recordings, there's a kind of like weird Eugene-ness to these bands and these songs. That's
the essence of Eugene.
Yeah, it's got this sense of humor, this, I don't even know what you call it, texture, flavor. It wasn't grunge. It wasn't what was happening up north, and it wasn't kind of what was happening like on the East Coast. It really had its own.
It was very DIY.
Yeah.
It kind of proto DIY, some of it. It was so early on. Just figure out a way to make the music, put it on a cassette or whatever. Don't worry about the record companies.
Yeah, almost like record companies. They're never gonna, they don't care about this. This is our thing, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah. And so you made a good kind of selection of all sorts of different things from the Panic blog. Was there a particular reasons that you chose these songs, or are they just kind of ones that you're fond of? Or
some that have a personal connection to me, but yeah, others that I'm just fond of and enjoy.
Yeah.
I kind of went through some of them that I wasn't so familiar with and picked out the one that kind of caught my attention, really.
Right. Yeah. I know that in terms of this set here, the things that stand out to me, just based on things that I was quite fond of, was Snake Pit and Moose Lodge.
Right, okay, good.
And Moose Lodge was one that kind of evolved into Billy Jack, a band that I saw several times when I first got to Eugene. And then,
right, and they were my neighbors at one point.
That's right, I think we talked about this.
Yeah, I heard them practice all the time.
Yeah, which you didn't know they were Billy Jack.
No, it was just this loud band, Jesus.
And you know, in that album, especially in the days before Jerry Garcia had passed away, kind of became a little bit of an anthem. The Billy Jack album became a little bit of an anthem for Eugene punks because it had this whole Bring Me the Head of Jerry Garcia.
Okay, which, right. Okay.
You know, whenever the Dead was doing a show at Autzen Stadium, I always felt like we had to march down 13th singing that Billy Jack song.
I hear you.
Which, you know, people feel differently depending on their relationship with the Grateful Dead, but I think Eugene punks in particular, and, you know, the folks in Moose Lodge and whatnot, were taking a stance kind of like, no, this is where we draw the line. We're not these kind of hippies.
Right, right, right. Well, yeah. I mean, there's a whole group of them called the Cheeseheads. You know, they were way more punk than they were hippie.
Right.
But, you know, they drank Genesis juice and worked at the co-ops and stuff too. You know.
It was just, they listened to different records.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So I recommend checking out the Moose Lodge a bit, and Snake Pit, what can I say? They were an amazing group that it kind of evolved into Oswald 5-0 and a number of other projects, and Mike Johnson had a whole career from that group. So the Snake Pit has some cool, wonderful gems that I recommend. Any other of these selections have any specific meaning or significance for why you picked them?
Well, the Headhunters had some friends of mine in it. Mm. And that piece, Anorexia, got a lot of airplay on KRVM, so I thought it might be kind of an iconic way to start the set.
Yeah. A slightly un-PC song, given today's...
In this day and age, yeah. Unacceptable, yeah. Sorry. Which,
I mean, this is also kind of a theme in a few of these songs, where, I mean, like, Anorexia is more of a tongue-in-cheek thing about being in love with... that look.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, some of these songs might hit that vein. I mean, it was the 80s. Sometimes people were inappropriate. Yeah. I quite like that one. It's got a good tune.
Yeah, it's catchy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. Well, The Treasure in Pity City is sung by my friend Elizabeth Riemann.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about
Robert,
who was in Snake Pit.
Yeah, and yeah. Robert, I mean, for me, I came to know him as the guy who worked at House of Records.
Right.
And so I would talk to him about, what do we recommend for someone who's really digging this Nation of Ulysses record or whatever.
Right. And you and Jeff Sellers in the interview talked about him quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I thought I would throw in those last two pieces for...
Unfortunately has passed, but a wonderful, wonderful gentleman.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Any other notes we need to mention on
Los
here?
Los Explorers is a popular rhythm and blues band featuring my friend Marlon Reiber singing vocals on that, and Ted Kellogg, who I've played with quite a lot in different bands, was the bassist. So, and they're the least famous members of that band, actually. So, you know, but yeah, go to the Panic on 13th blog and find out more about any of these.
Now, this is something I was quite curious about, because there's two selections from this session that we include in this show.
Yeah,
with Stick Against Stone, and the reason that this session is notable is because it was with HR of Bad Brains.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, Stick Against Stone, we've talked about briefly when you were on my program, and I'll put a link into that show in the notes so people can find that.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
We didn't talk about how you ended up doing a session with HR from Bad Brains.
Right, well, I wasn't there at the time. Mm. I had quit the band by then.
Oh, right, that's right, because this was the next, right after that.
Right, yeah. So yes, this was a band that I was in, but no longer when this recording was made. And so I never met HR or worked with them.
But they had become friends somehow?
Yeah, earlier, before I joined the band, they lived in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bad Brains allowed them to park their bus in front of their building and rehearse in their studio. So that's their association with them.
Interesting. And so that just kind of relationship evolved out of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, these recordings, of course, have never been released.
No.
So this is kind of the only way you can hear these kinds of things. HR wasn't too into these being released.
I'm not so sure the rest of the band was either, but you know,
mm-hmm.
It's got to be heard. I love it, so
yeah,
there it is for you.
I would definitely like to point out the Michael Billings recording, Life on the Farm, only because I think it's interesting to hear somebody who is doing a almost kind of Sonic Youth, Glenn Branca kind of sound in the Eugene music community.
Yeah, what's the year on that? 1988.
Yeah, he was definitely ahead of the curve.
Yeah,
so I quite appreciate that one. And then got to talk about the old shirt
by Bunny Summer, which of course was Jeff Sellers' band, and this of course concerns Jeff Sellers.
Yeah, so we got to play a little bit.
Being all about his blog.
Yeah, play a little bit of that. I don't remember much about So Belly, a few chairs. I don't really remember them that much. I remember digging the song, but I don't They weren't something that I was actually, I didn't know them in the day.
Yeah, I guess they were the more off the charts than most, but they were real good.
Mm-hmm. I think we maybe briefly mentioned this. Maybe, no, actually, it was off mic, where the Insidious Menace was more known for the graffiti than the
graffiti, yes. They had, it's sort of like a saw blade shape with a face drawn on it.
Yeah.
And it was all over town at the time.
My old roommate, the Ramen City Kid, who was there for the first half of this show, mm-hmm. doing the weather reports, he had very vivid memories of the Insidious Menace.
Yeah,
graffiti all over town.
We need for a band, huh? But I knew a couple guys in it, so.
Oh yeah,
I threw that on.
And then this is my favorite section of the show because we have like the only studio recording by the Drills, and then every recording by E13.
There you go. It all fits, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I guess there's more Drills out there, but this is the only kind of recording they made. And the E13 stuff is kind of hard to find, so it's a good place to hear it if you don't want to pay a lot
for Yeah, it's record. Super expensive. If you happen to find one for sale on eBay or whatever, it's going to be a couple $100.
Yeah, but yeah, you can hear it here for free on this podcast.
There you go. So,
and then you know, my selection to kind of cap off the panic section of the show,
right.
Is the K Pants song, right. Or Pants as they were affectionately known, because the K is silent.
That's right.
I can't say enough nice things about them. I love the K Pants album. I love their singles. There's an old promo photo of me as a DJ holding a K Pants single in my hands. Wow. I'm quite fond of that group, and they do a wonderful cover of a Jonathan Richman song, if I do say so myself. So
right, which is what we played.
Yeah, but yeah, that's the panic section. I guess we should quickly mention our switched off Eugene little section here. I feel like we've talked about this a whole bunch, but for people who haven't yet heard us talk about it, there was a wonderful Numero Group compilation released recently that has electronic music from Eugene performers and recording artists from the Eugene Electronic Music Collective. But more pointedly, the liner notes are written by Zeres of Zeron.
That's right.
And so these are not from that compilation, but stuff that would fit into that...
The coulda, woulda, shoulda, yeah.
...vein
right?
of things.
And actually, some of them aren't really done with synthesizers. So that's kind of why I called it off rather than on. Switched off instead of switched on.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds like it's electronic. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. And, you know, Carl Juarez, who was a big kind of player in a lot of different ways for the EEMC.
Right.
I was glad we included one of his tunes. So.
Right. And the tune that is included on the Switched On Eugene compilation is called Self-Regulation 2. So I figured we just play Self-Regulation 1.
Complete the cycle.
That's right.
Yeah. Nice. Now, this was one of the tapes that you brought in, David Stewart.
Right.
Kind of...
Don't know much about him.
Yeah.
I met him and, you know, he explained his music to me. and this is... a result of his experiences working at an industrial laundry.
Oh, wow.
And he just used like broken guitars and stacks of effects and things to sort of emulate the sound of his experience there with the washing machines going and everything.
Hmm.
So, that piece is called Soil Count.
Nice.
Which is some technical term for how they measure how clean they got the garments that they were laundering.
Right.
Right.
Soil count. Got it. Yeah. Here's one from the Free Fall tape, which I originally misidentified as what was being released by the Numero Group. I thought it was going to be a reissue of the Free Fall tape, but it wasn't.
Not quite, yeah.
It's a variety of things, but this is actually from that Free Fall tape. Another one you brought in for this show.
Yeah.
Yeah, Daryl Parsons.
Daryl Parsons, right? Not even musically trained, but he just enjoyed working with the synthesizers, and he just had his own feeling about how it should be, and created some pretty amazing stuff in his time.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that leads into, oh, yes, the onomatopoeia.
Right.
Now, this was something I remembered quite fondly from when I first moved to Eugene, because I remember a friend forcing me to listen to onomatopoeia while I was on acid once. And so that definitely stood out as a memorable...
I could see how that would happen.
Moment, yes. Yeah.
And it is trippy stuff.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Very, very, it was a duo, I think, and had...
I remember it being larger. We could look it up,
though. Yeah, maybe there was just two main gents.
The guy I knew was Arlen, and then there was Vince also.
Yeah.
They were the mainstays, I think.
But nonetheless, I have good memories of that. And then Heather Perkins.
Right. She's from Eugene also. And I think she's now based in Portland. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. And got made a pretty good name for herself, you know, since then as well.
Yeah,
so.
She's put out a few albums, and they're all good. And so this, combined with the onomatopoeia piece, are kind of proto-EDM.
Yeah,
if you ask me, kind of early days of electronic dance music, because they have kind of a dance beat to them. And
yeah, well, and it was like that late 90s sound, kind of a couple years early, basically.
Sure.
You know, yeah, very much so. And then we close that first two-hour set, that first two-hour show,
right,
in this little block here, with Entrail, an artist that no longer lives in Eugene, but represents a little bit of that sound.
Yep.
Yeah. And so that was part one. Like I said, that was last week's show that we did.
Yes.
And so we're now having this conversation pretty much immediately after we did part two, which was earlier today.
Yep.
And now, like, we kind of divided this into two sections because we wanted to have, you know, that one, which, you know, that part of the show, the first half, was a lot more kind of like various artists. Mm-hmm. Here we're kind of doing like artist concentration.
Yeah, a little focus here.
And this is kind of very specific too, because some of these artists were very prolific had a variety of things that they did in their careers.
Right.
And so it's good to not just reduce them to one track, but like have a few different samples of what they do. So that was this week's show. How did we lead that off?
Well, we started out with the Amy Denio section.
Yeah.
Which I just called About Amy.
And this is somebody who, I mean, I've been hearing about for a long time. A lot of people have a very, almost kind of like cult-like dedication to her recordings and whatnot. And,
that's good to know.
So this is somebody that I always want to know more about, because she's very mysterious to me.
Well, good. Glad we could introduce her to you.
Yeah.
She's from Seattle. So, not super local to the Salem area, but Northwest nonetheless. Started in the mid-1980s as part of a sort of an avant-garde jazz scene there. And she's just kind of quirky. Did a lot of four-track cassette recordings, overdubbing herself onto herself. Because she's a multi-instrumentalist, bass, harmonica, guitar, and of course saxophone.
So unless she's playing in a group, when it says Amy Denio, it's her doing all of those instruments, all of the singing, harmonizing with herself.
Not necessarily always, but quite frequently.
Okay.
Yeah, especially in those early releases, which is kind of what we're focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She had a band called Tone Dogs, which was a project she did with bassist Fred Challoner, along with the drummer from Soundgarden, Matt Cameron.
Oh, Interesting.
And it's kind of a prog band, but with whimsical leanings, because Amy DiNaio likes to do whimsical things. And Fred was kind of a whimsical guy, too. He's recently deceased.
Yeah. And Fred had a group as well.
And it was called Caveman Shoe Store.
Yeah.
And I brought a little demo that he did before the formation of Caveman Shoe Store that was just a kind of a proof of concept. So it's mostly just bass only tracks.
Yeah.
And we played one of those tonight.
Yeah. This is kind of interesting, too, because, I mean, obviously, a lot of these names are names that I've heard for a long time here and there, but it's good to kind of, like, actually connect some of these dots, you know? Because, like, I always assume that everybody knows each other, but actually, they all actually played in each other's bands.
Right,
it's
right.
Not even that they knew each other.
Well, and Fred Challoner even played in my band at one point.
Right, yeah.
And that's where he met Pete, our vocalist.
Right.
And they kind of struck up a friendship. And Pete actually went to Fred's house to do a little duet with him. And Fred broke out his acoustic bass. And Fred did his usual improv poetry. And a couple of those tracks turned out great. And you get to hear one of them.
Yeah. Very cool.
That's the one called Better Mousetrap.
Yeah. Any other Amy DiNaio things worth noting? Oh, I guess Billy Tipton.
Yeah, she was in the Billy Tipton Memorial Saxophone Quartet.
Yes.
And it's kind of a powerhouse of female saxophonists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty excellent performance, too. But that's like one of the cases where she's in the band and it's not her project.
I think it kind of... you know, I don't really know the history, but I'm pretty sure she was one of the founding members.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool. Right on.
Yeah.
Well, and then our next artist that we focused on for this half of the show was...
Trey Gunn.
Trey Gunn, yeah. Now, this is one of those things, when I first moved to Eugene, I kind of heard these... Because this was, you know, before my time when he was around. So, like, I had heard that he had a Eugene connection, but...
Oh, yeah.
I was always kind of sitting there going, like, whoa, how is that? How does he have a Eugene? You know, like, it didn't make sense to me. And then, over time, I have been proved wrong over and over again.
Right.
This is a few selections from him and then a band that he was in.
Right. Called Punishment Farm. That was his band in his Eugene days. I might mention, in case people don't know, Trey Gunn was a member of King Crimson.
Yeah, I guess we were dancing around why you would know who he was.
Right. Not from the beginning, but just between 1994 and 2003.
Right.
So, but yeah, he went to music school in Eugene, Oregon. And in fact, I saw his senior recitation.
Oh, really?
To get his degree. In classical music composition.
Wow.
From the School of Music there at the U of O.
Interesting.
So I actually caught that, and it was a bunch of boom boxes. I think about 10 or 12 of them.
Oh, wow.
And he stationed people all along the aisles of the Bell Concert Hall.
Okay.
And... had them all push the button at the same time. That was him conducting to make sure everybody pushed the button on the boombox simultaneously.
That's funny.
And the result was this total surround sound situation with 10 different channels to it. And so the sound would like swirl around the hall.
Interesting.
You know, and your head would turn and everything. It was amazing.
Wow.
And you can't even reproduce that on a recording or a record.
Yeah, because with stereo.
maybe now with the surround sound system.
Yeah, I guess you could reproduce it in like a 5.1 kind of thing or whatever.
It wouldn't be a 10, 12 or 10.
Yeah, exactly.
You could maybe come close. Or, back in the old days.
How cool that you got to see that, though.
Quadraphonic. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was there, man.
That's so cool.
So, and then later he goes and joins King Crimson. Well, go figure. You
know? Did you get to see Punishment Farm, too, or...
I believe I saw it on the cable on the
cable access yeah, which was probably shot by Jeff if I'm not mistaken, because I think he
was involved in that, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think he was one of the few people that was filming a lot of stuff in those days.
Right.
How funny is that?
Right.
Well, in these selections too, there's more in the podcast version because we couldn't play everything on the radio for time.
We ran out of time because of the radio marathon.
Yeah, the pledge drive. But like some of these selections are things that are just rare Trey Gunn recordings and things.
Yeah,
like
his
that.
Eugene era cassette releases and some things he did before he joined King Crimson.
Yeah.
He was promoting the Chapman Stick at the time, and he went on tour playing Chapman Stick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a combination bass and guitar, in case you don't know.
Right.
All on one fretboard.
It's a weird
without
looking,
much of a body.
Yeah, it's a very weird looking thing. Yeah. It's kind of cool though.
Yeah, you know, they're kind of neat. We have one in my band actually.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of nice to hear some of these people. We talked about this a lot off mic when we were doing this show, but Trey's, I think, a very good example of this, where, you know, for example, he might not want these recordings distributed on a CD for sale in a store,
right.
But I think that this illustrates his progression as an artist, where you get to hear him grow and develop, and,
yeah,
you know, like, by the end, you know why King Crimson wants him.
Right.
You know?
You know, like, if you study literature, you know, and you're doing a paper or something, a lot of times you'll break into the letters of the
right.
author in question. You try to dig deeper into his personal life and, you know, and his history, and maybe dig into his more embarrassing early writings, you know, that never really got published. And that's kind of what we're trying to do, is provide that for future researchers.
That context, yeah, yeah. Now, this section here is the probably most personal section of
yes,
the show.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you here. Now, you've been on the program before,
right.
Where we've talked about your work and recordings.
Yeah, you've allowed me to slip a few into the airwaves.
Yeah, with Giant Worm and
right.
then your solo work as well. But this is another kind of selection of stuff that you worked on, that were a part of, that are part
yeah.
of your career.
Right.
And these are selections that you made of your own work. So I'm kind of curious
yeah.
why you picked these.
Just because they deserve to be out there in some form or fashion.
Sure.
And that's the main thing.
And this is kind of a couple of different bits of your recorded history. There's a
and friends of mine, not just me.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe we did have to trim a thing or two from the broadcast, but
yeah.
we will include all of them in the podcast.
Right? There you go. So we need to explain all of it, don't
yeah.
we?
Yeah. So let's talk about these selections.
All right. Well, this first part of this section was I started with Daniel Ramirez, who was in Stick Against Stone, but this is some of his solo material, and this is called Curse of the Devils. And then I was going to play another one by him, but we had to cut it out, so
okay,
so there'll be two in the podcast.
You'll hear both of those in the podcast yeah. version. Yeah.
And then, speaking of guitarists in bands that I was in, Kevin Dow did this piece called Oven Door.
Yeah.
he was my guitarist in Fate versus Free Will Turn Signals.
Yeah.
But this is not a guitar piece. This is he did on a DX7 Yamaha synthesizer. A
lot of samples.
Because he took that class at LCC, the electronic music class.
Right. I took this course.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, yeah. My mother also took it the year before me. And she recommended it. And so
Wow.
I ended up taking it because of that.
And of course, that is associated with the Eugene Electronic Music Collective guys.
Yes, yeah, which I did not know when I took this course.
because a lot of them either took it or taught it.
Mm-hmm. And I ended up passing that on to my bandmate in Cathead. He heard that I'd taken this course and was like, what? And then immediately signed up for it in the next term.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my guitarist Kevin took that, and this was his class project, Oven Door.
Nice.
Or one of them. There's several really nice ones he did. And then we move on to something that I did called AIDS Quilt. And it was just some samples I took off the radio and TV newscasts. And it happened to be about the AIDS quilt at the time. This was back in 80... I don't know, 3-ish or something.
Whenever that was.
Right. So me and my friend Rob Dowling ran it through a digital delay. And, we added some other samples and keyboards and things to it.
And this is kind of another personal example of that thing we were talking about with Trey Gunn, where you were telling me off mic when we were playing this that you used to hate this recording.
Yeah.
But that over time you have kind of seen more value in it and have kind of come to like it and
right. So I've listened to a lot more experimental music, partly through my association with you and involvement in the Olympia Experimental Music Festival, where I've played a few times. And so I've been exposed to more of it, and which gives me a more appreciation for my own experimental stuff that I kind of dismissed.
Because sometimes when you're fooling around in the studio on your own, you really think it's garbage. Because you're just fooling around. You're like, I don't know, and whatnot. And it takes that distance to realize, actually, that was a skill that I developed by making that mistake over and over again.
Right. And, and it's deeply political, too. Which it was only a result of random sampling. So I didn't get the political aspect of it because I didn't intend that,
Until,
but it's there.
It is. And I think it's one of those pieces, too, where sometimes accidents do yield better results.
I'm a surrealist at heart.
Right.
Or a Dadaist, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
They both rely on accidental contributions to creative endeavors.
Now, we included a Fate versus Free Will Turnziggles tune as well, which that was like a band you were in for a substantial period, I understand.
88 to 92-ish, 1-ish, something like that.
Yeah. And then, let's see, did you have the...
The Blue Light Studio.
That's right, the Salem Group.
Yeah, they're from Salem.
Yeah, and what's your connection to that?
I don't know if it's even really a group. It was a studio.
Oh, okay.
Started in my friend Lee's bedroom.
Oh.
And it was just guys that he'd get together with and jam out with. And they did some cover songs. They did some originals. And then I just threw this little piece because they're kind of goofing around.
Mm-hmm.
Singing an a cappella piece called Singing a Cappello.
Right.
And I just thought it would be a nice intro to another vocal piece.
Yeah, for sure.
And so this is my friend Elizabeth Riemann with Paul Sturz. And Paul was a DJ at KRVM, introduced me to a lot of great music, like Camper Van Beethoven and the Minutemen.
Nice. That's a good combo.
But then he, moved on in life and eventually ended up in Columbia, Missouri, where he was in the city council.
Oh, funny.
For a while, and he founded a film festival called the True False Film Festival.
Nice.
Which is, growing every year.
Yeah. And I would say that we were pretty certain that the Circle K they're talking about is the one on 13th.
Yep, the one near House of Records.
Yes. And then we close this section off with a little studio jam by Giant Worm.
Right.
Yeah, which is a recent recording.
Pretty recent, back last July.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good.
Yep, Mousy Centauri, we call it.
Yeah. And then actually podcast listeners will get one more after that, the other...
Daniel, the other Dan Ramirez
tune. Yeah. Nice. Now, were there any other reasons why you chose those in that order, or is that just they all have good personal connections, or?
Well, the order was just because I thought it flowed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then, yeah, just the personal connections with most of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, our last section and the last thing we have to talk about here is we closed with a live set by a group, Remembering Valets, or
Remember Valsets.
Valsets.
Their name was Remember Valsets.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this briefly on the air before we play this, but this is basically like a full live set with introductions and
right.
bits in between and the whole kit and caboodle. We on air had to cut a bit, but
it gets the idea across.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell us about this one. Why this set? Why this band? Why what?
For me, since we're doing Northwest Notes,
yeah,
that's what the program's all about. I just thought, okay, well, it's neat. People are from here, you know, or have some involvement with this area,
right?
But what about singing about this area and issues that pertain to this area? And this band really addresses some of the vital political issues. You know, they were more prevalent back in the 80s when this was recorded.
But sure.
I think timber issues are still a factor in Oregon, Washington.
100%.
You know, the spotted owl kind of exemplifies. It's kind of iconic.
Yeah.
For both sides. I remember I worked as a janitor once, and in the one of my clients was a sheet metal manufacturer, and they had a big poster on a wall that said, "No more tissue, no more towel. Wipe my ass with a spotted owl."
Oh, yes. I remember a lot of that kind of stuff from... You know, also growing up in the same area, I lived in Oak Ridge in those years, and that was certainly affected by all of that. I remember protests in the streets where people were like, you know, cut down those trees. We don't care about owls.
And, right.
You know, all that
stuff. So there
was
a lot of division in the community over timber issues.
Yeah.
You know, because there were timber workers losing their jobs and, you know, there was Earth First movement trying to prevent any kind of timber from being cut.
I remember a lot of old growth. I remember a lot of division among people because this was an issue that people talked about, and so families suddenly realized which side of it they stood on, and you know,
it was our own little civil war.
Yeah, it was.
So this band, Remember Valsets, tried to sort of unify the two sides. And address these issues head on with some clever lyrics. But I think they had sympathy for timber families as well as for environmental concerns.
Yeah.
And Valsets was a town in Polk County. It was a mill town, and Boise Cascade shut it down in 1983. And the place was abandoned, and so it's kind of like this ghost town, pretty close to here in Salem.
Wow, it's such a funny thing too, because like, you know, we do talk about making local music, local politics, local art, and whatnot, and this is one of those things that is like hyper local, and largely forgotten now. I hadn't heard of this group until you mentioned it, and you know, in a way, we started the show in that same fashion, where, you know, like we played something from Monmouth just down the street,
right,
and then we closed with this band that's basically singing about something also just down the road,
right.
You know, it's like,
even though I'm from Eugene, I wanted Salem to be a big part of this.
Yeah, I wanted to have this conversation added in mostly because we didn't have these kinds of chats while we were playing these songs throughout the show. We were trying to cram in as much music, but also because, you know, thank you very much for doing this.
Usually, when
people want to come and play songs on the radio, they don't give it this much thought.
Right.
You know, and I mean, like, this was, you know, so well prepared, so lovingly crafted, and everything flowed so well that I felt like we had to have a little more love given to it at the end as a, right. this little tag. So anything else before we kind of wrap this up?
Well, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to just put this out there. You know, I'm starting to get a little bit old here and need things to be passed on. You know?
Well, that some of these stories
picks it up.
Some of these stories can slip away if we don't capture them. You know, because like unfortunately with rock and roll, it is like in oral tradition. People really do kind of like forget this stuff if they're not paying attention.
Right.
So well, thank you so much, Zeres of Zeron.
You're welcome.
Coming in and this is a little bonus tidbit about these 4 hours of radio that you just heard.